Hello, and welcome to episode 256 of The Ethical Life, a weekly podcast that explores the intersection of ethics and modern life. I'm Scott Rada, a digital strategist with Lee Enterprises, and I'm joined as always by Rick Kite, who is head of the Ethics Institute at Viterbo University in La Crosse, Wisconsin. Hello, Rick.
Hi, Scott.
Let's say my car needs a new transmission. I have two choices. I can either take it to a reputable transmission shop, or I can have my neighbor fix it because he considers himself a car guy. For most all of us, that's an easy decision. We trust the specialist. But what's interesting is that we don't always approach other parts of our lives the same way. Whether it's medicine, education, journalism, economics, or public health, many people seem much more skeptical of experts than they once were. And the internet has given us access to an incredible amount of information, and now AI can answer almost any question in seconds. It's easier than ever to do our own research. Rick, to me this raises an important question. Has technology made us better informed, or has it simply made us more confident, and why do experts still deserve our trust?
I'm not sure that experts still deserve our trust. And this is one of the problems we're having in our society right now is it's hard to know who the experts are. How do we verify the credentials? So somebody claims to be an expert. They have certain credentials. What are their motivations? What are they doing this for? Go back to your example of the transmission. Let's say that it's your neighbor who considers himself a car guy. He doesn't want to fix your transmission. But you mentioned to them that you have got transmission and you're planning to take it to Transmissions R Us because they get the best reviews on Google.
And they're probably expensive.
And they're expensive. And he says, oh, no, don't go there. I've had a couple of friends who've gone there. They haven't had a good experience. Most of those reviews, he says, are probably fake. Go to Acme Transmissions. Those are the guys. I know them. And tell them that you know me and they'll treat you well. You're going to go there because you have some context for the recommendation and you've met the person. We tend to establish trust based on relationships. And right now, we don't have relationships with most of the experts. And we're going right from like our little community where we know certain people. And we kind of know who to trust and who not to trust. This is what happens within a traditional community. And you go from that to like a national or even international context where you have all of these reviews. You don't know where they're coming from and all these people with credentials. Who do you trust and who don't you trust? We don't really know.
You know, as we continue this discussion, I think there's going to be a fair amount of overlap between what we're calling experts and what we more broadly call institutions, right? Because institutions are much or oftentimes just simply a group of experts. And I think it's true to say that for, say, the last 25 years, Americans have become less trustful of institutions. I'm not convinced in any way that's good. I mean, I think we should always have some level of skepticalness, if that's a word, and that we should, you know, we don't want to be taken advantage of. And I think that's something that people were worried about 100 years ago and should be worried about today. I am not convinced that experts today are worse than they were 25 years ago. I don't think they're out to get us more than they were 25 years ago. I just think that we have access to just enough information to make us skeptical some of the time about these people. And I am not convinced that a lot of that is good.
Yeah, what's happened is the context within which trust is traditionally established has eroded so severely that we have a hard time trying to determine, like, who should we trust and who shouldn't we?
But we did not that we had none of that 25, 30, 35 years ago, but we have less of that. Do you agree?
Less of what?
Less of that worry about who to trust.
Yeah, we did. But we also had certain experts who were closer to home. And what I mean by that is universities house a lot of expertise.
Mm-hmm.
It used to be, whether it was a private college or a state-sponsored university, if they're in different towns or cities, quite a few of the people would have local connections. And the people who are working at those universities were members of churches, of service organizations. Like, they were involved in their communities where they worked and where they taught. And so you knew certain experts. Like, you would go to church with them. You might know them for, like, you'd see them at the grocery store, all that sort of thing. That has been something that's pretty much completely lost in most universities. The experts are coming in not because of any connection they have to the geographic area. It's a teaching position that gets them the next step on their ladder as they work towards tenure. Because somebody like me who's an academic, I used to have to work with people who are around me that I could collaborate with. And so most of my conversations would be with my colleagues or other colleagues that might be within the in the region. So I had to be involved more in my local community. Now, most communities of scholars are online. And the people, if you ask somebody who's a professor, say, in biology or engineering, whatever it happens to be, who they are working with on some project, it's people at other universities. They say they don't have time to be involved in their local communities, and so you don't know who they are. So the person who's maybe like 10 blocks away teaching at a university, you've never met them. And they're just as much a stranger to you as somebody who's teaching out, say, in California, thousands of miles away. How do we establish trust in expertise when we don't know any of the experts?
And I guess it's probably important in this discussion, too, to define, like, how one becomes an expert. I mean, I'll ask, I guess, you directly. Do you consider yourself to be an expert on ethics? And if so, when did that happen?
I started being called by other people an expert in ethics long before I thought of myself that way. I think of myself that way now. Well, I've been teaching a lot longer and I've been writing a lot longer. And so there's certain problems that I've thought about long enough that I'm pretty confident in what the answers are. But there's more that I don't know than what I would say than I know. And so I'm still uncomfortable being called an expert.
But people call you that often, probably.
Yeah. And so I don't contest it anymore.
Mm-hmm.
But I just...
But you used to?
I used to say, no, I'm not an expert. I teach ethics, but mm-hmm. And still, my job mostly in teaching ethics is helping students ask better questions. It's not telling them what to think about ethics. It's like saying, well, like, what are the most important questions to ask? And like, we think of experts as people who have the answers. I think of myself as somebody who has better questions than we typically ask. You are right that we should have more confidence in what many of the experts are telling us about social problems, environmental problems, technological problems, because if we just look at the evidence, our world has much more knowledge about all kinds of things. There's all kinds of research that's gone on. There's a lot of good evidence we have to look at. The problem is, what we don't understand is trust is based on relationships. It's not based on evidence.
And the reason I started the show by talking about a car transmission is I'm not an expert on cars. I know my car has a transmission. I think it shifts gears somehow, and I know it's an automatic transmission. I know I one time had a manual transmission. I have now told you everything I know about transmissions. So if I, you know, I actually had a vehicle many years ago, the transmission went out and I knew two things were true. Transmissions are important and they're expensive. And I had it fixed. I've so far removed from being an expert on that. I think that's a similar thing that a lot of folks have, right? They drive their cars, they're happy when they work, and when they don't work, especially with new cars today, they're complicated and big pieces of electronics. Yeah. So I think for a lot of people, that just seems overwhelming, and you're just looking for someone who seems like an expert because you know something needs to get fixed. I'll take something, an entirely different example, though, and I had a very low-stakes disagreement with a hospital procedure, we'll call it, a few months ago. And I mean, nothing, I mean, it was not even like whether I was sick or not sick. It was just sort of about a process thing. And had probably more discussions than I'd like to admit with the healthcare institution, because like how they presented this and how they shared this information with me and the options I was given, I just thought was like not good. And like the more I talked to them, and this obviously, I mean, it affects my body, I mean, versus like my car. So that seems like a more important thing. And like, I kind of probably came across talking to them like I knew how their business ran and how they should run it better and run it differently, because from a patient standpoint, this is how I felt. And I know if they would have done X and Y and Z, I would have felt differently about this. And they should probably go in and rethink their policies because this just doesn't make sense. Now, this is a large healthcare institution. Not that any large institution can't make mistakes, not that any large institution can't get better. But, you know, looking back on this a couple of months later and thinking about this in conjunction with today's topic, I mean, there are people whose like entire professional lives are devoted to like hospital processes and procedures. And those people probably listen to people like me who think, well, I know how they could make this better. Seems maybe like, well, you worry about your area of expertise and I'll worry about mine, and we'll let the other guy across town worry about transmissions and we'll all become experts on our own thing. But let's all agree that we know more about our circle of knowledge than most other people. But there are like certain topics, it seems, that like everybody thinks they know more than the people who are in charge. And I guess, you know, the biggest one of that, I think, in this country is politics. And I guess that's kind of a long way of getting to this question. I think if you had a very specific health issue, like everybody would say, find the one physician who is an expert on that rare disease, and he or she can point you in a good direction for treatment and give you the best possible outcome. But if we're voting for someone, whether it's at the state, local, or national level, being an outsider, being someone who has a fresh and new perspective is so often sort of like the winning argument versus someone who's been serving on the city council or the county board or the state legislature for 35 years. And I find that sort of weird. And I know that's an unpopular position to take, but they may not, assuming they hold broadly some of the same preferences on policy that you do, it seems like those people probably have a better way of getting some of that policy enacted versus someone who just is emboldened and walks in off the street with some new ideas. So that's a lot to piece together. But does any of that make sense to you?
I want to go back to your analogy first.
Sure.
And
I gave you a lot to go with.
You gave me a lot to go with. And so I'm going to come back to politics.
Okay.
But I'm going to start out the analogy of the visit to the hospital. So I was talking with somebody recently who this is their experience. And because I agree, like generally, like medical experts and so forth, they have their credentials and so forth. We should trust them. They know more about what they're doing than we know. But that's in general. That's in the abstract. When we have a specific problem where we really need healthcare, then it's us in particular. And the question is, do I give my trust right now about this specific problem that I have that I care more about than anything else right now because I'm in pain? And it's not enough to say, well, in general, they know a lot more than you do, so just go and follow whatever advice they give you. So this is the experience of somebody I talked to recently. Went to the ER with some pain. They gave him some pain reliever and said, you're fine. Went back the next day when it had gotten much worse. Still dismissive. They did a little bit more investigating. They say, yeah, go back home. You've got typical symptoms. Then that person contacted a retired doctor that they knew who could speak the language, who came with them for the third visit to that ER. And that doctor said, look, here's what you need to do. You need to do much more thorough testing. In other words, what he did is he got somebody who cared about him. It's not that the doctor friend who went with him knew more than the others, but he cared more. And that caring was then insistent on getting the treatment, and turned out he had a really serious problem that needed emergency care. Okay? Without that patient advocate, he wouldn't have gotten it, or it would have taken much longer. This is where we find ourselves with regard to expertise lots of times. It's not an abstract question of who knows the most in general. It's a question about, like, who really cares about our interests? And that always implies some kind of relationship. You know, it's not an abstract question. It's a personal, it's a real question. So when we come to politics, a lot of it isn't just who knows more about, like, what are the best answers to all kinds of social policies and so forth. Who cares most? Who's going to be our advocate? Who's going to work on our behalf? And voters tend to be drawn to the people that they know in some way. That's why you have a lot of skepticism about politicians in general, a lot of frustration, but people tend to vote for their incumbents over and over, right? I even talked to a local politician one time who mentioned that, heck, he was out going door to door one time campaigning because he was running for re-election, and somebody told him, you know, I disagree with just about every vote you've taken, but I'm still going to vote for you because I know where you stand. Like, and you think, well, that's an odd, but why vote for somebody that you know you're going to disagree with? But he could trust him, even though he disagreed.
And I mean, sticking on politics for just a second, but I remember, and I won't mention their names on the show, but there were two local state legislators in our area who I'm sure you know both. And this was probably, they were probably at their peak 15 years ago. And they were both of the same party, both took many of the same votes, but were such different people. One would go to every parade, you know, speak at every little civic group, and was just a very, wanted to be everywhere all the time, and really enjoyed that part of the job, I sincerely believe.
Yep.
And then the other person in his party, many of the same positions, was very much sort of the technocrat, like, you know, could tell you, could count the votes in the state legislature. One time I had a talk with him years ago about, you know, he had this really broad look at the state, and he's like, well, I think in district, you know, 17, we have this person running against this person, and I think our candidate's going to win the day for these three reasons, and was very tactical in his approach. Did he do some of that other community stuff? Probably. Is that why he got into the job? Not at all. And to me, and this is probably where maybe you and I are different, like I think if I were in that, I'm not going to be in politics, but I really more related to the tactical guy, right? The mm-hmm. person who sort of looked at things in as far as white papers and, you know, vote counting and how we can get this, how we can adjust policy to get just enough votes to get most of what we want. And I would not be the person who's going to be out at the chicken dinners on every Sunday, seeing what the farmers and small town village board members really have to say. I mean, maybe I care, maybe I don't. I bet you're the opposite, though.
Not really.
Okay.
I mean, the technocrat is probably going to be spending more time analyzing policy, reading, you know, drafting bills very carefully and working behind the scenes. And in a way, that's what we want politicians to spend their time doing, because it's a very complicated business of drafting policy responsibly. But I still want to know, even if it's a technocrat, I want to know it's a technocrat that has our genuine interests at heart. And how do I know that if I don't have any kind of relationship? And this is where the problem comes in. Like, I really want somebody who's going to invest their time more on maybe the technical side of the job. But that's the person that it's harder for me to trust, because how do I know that their heart's in the right place, that they have, you know, my interest in mind when they're drafting that technical, because they could have malevolent purposes in mind and I wouldn't know. And they might be much better than at that.
Just to kind of recenter for a moment our conversation back to experts, one of the sort of seminal moments in the past decade where experts took center stage was during the early days of the COVID pandemic. I think, obviously, I don't want to relitigate that, our entire nation's response to that. But I think there was some criticism, you know, at the time and certainly in the years after, about some public health officials and positions they took. And I think a lot of that approach was well-intended, and they were doing the best job they could in reacting to something that none of them had really lived through, only maybe things they had read in books and more theoretical ways. But there are sort of two things that I came back to and still come back to where I think the experts around the early days of COVID may have failed us a little bit. One, I think at times they spoke a little too confidently, because I think if you would have asked them quietly behind the scenes, they would have said, hey, we're giving the best advice we can, but we need to sound confident because that'll get people to listen to us. And I think expressing a little more sincerity about how they really felt might have been useful. But I think the most important thing, though, was that if you're a public health expert and you know that there are two or three things, one of them certainly being quarantining people during this is helpful to stop the spread of this. And that's, you know, undoubtedly true. But I think experts can sometimes get so only look at things through their lens, in this case, only the public health lens. And, you know, we could have, you know, and I guess some countries sort of tried this, right? They're a little more autocratic, where they had like really severe quarantine rules. I'm not going to argue whether that was good or not in the long scope of the disease, but no, they did not take into account sort of the second order things around, you know, when you're being kept away from, you know, people socially, when you're keeping kids out of school, when you're keeping businesses closed and maybe to never open again. And I think the public health people would say, hey, that's all too bad. But like, we're looking at this as a public health emergency, and this is what we know will be the best thing to stop it. And I think sometimes experts look at things so narrowly that they just don't think, how else do these policies and procedures we're recommending affect people more broadly? Do you agree with any of that?
Yeah, and I'll say it's related to what I was saying about the ways in which universities have changed, so that we have experts in certain kinds of fields that they're in regular conversation with colleagues studying the very same things across the nation, because a lot of their dialogue is online now through email and so forth. But they're less integrated into their communities. And so the experts themselves don't do as good a job of connecting the policies they're developing and recommending with the actual lives of people in communities. And that became really evident during COVID, where we found policies being applied in ways that were pretty obviously inconsistent with good recommendations at the local level, because they were trying to make like these national recommendations that applied in very broad categories. And so they weren't sufficiently nuanced. And they focused then, so because there was pushback, the experts started focusing more on messaging than on just communicating truthfully what did they know and what didn't they know. And the more pushback they get, they got, the more rigid the recommendations became, and the less responsive they became to making like local exceptions where those are warranted. And so pretty soon you're finding like policies about masking that's applying to two and three-year-olds in preschools. So here's my wife working at a preschool where like little kids are chewing on their masks and getting them sopping wet and then taking them off and handing them to teachers. I mean, they're transmitting all kinds of germs because they've got these masks that are always on their mouth and they're never staying in place. They're not providing any disease protection whatsoever, as they do and could in older children or adults. Why are they being applied to three-year-olds? Because it's policy. And it was stupid, right? And we look back on it now and say, yeah, that was a really stupid thing to do. But then you have people at the local level and they're looking at this and saying, like, what's going on with these recommendations? They make no sense. And it's true they didn't, but it's because the experts were so focused on the messaging and making sure their messaging was consistent. And I found this to be really problematic is when the experts get pushback because they're not really in direct communication with people at the local community level. They're mostly in communication with one another. Their responses aren't nuanced and they don't respond to the real concerns of communities. And that's a problem. It's no surprise that a lot of suspicion develops, but then what happens is the suspicion gets carried too far. The distrust gets carried too far. And so people start doubting everything that experts have to say. And I would say, like, most of it makes a lot of sense. We should take it very seriously. It's just that they can overreach in the same way that, like, distrust can overreach.
And I think, you know, I'll use COVID since we're speaking about that as an example, but I think this is true in most cases, is that if you're an expert in your field, that you went into this area because you find it interesting, because you may have an aptitude for it, and in many cases, because that area that you're interested in can, like, actually help people. And again, that can be medicine, it can be any number of things. I'm certain, like any field, there are always going to be people in it for the wrong reasons. But I, just like I think most people who run transmission shops are doing their very best to serve their customers and install transmissions properly and make happy customers, because most people who start small businesses know that that's the only real way to succeed. I think that's the reason public health people go into public health. That's the reason I even think, and many will disagree, that that's why most people, especially at the state and local level, go into politics, is they really want to make a difference. They feel that the policies they believe in are important and can help people's lives. But I think there are so many of us who look at the transmission shop owner, the public health official, the politician, and who sincerely believe that they're not acting in good faith, that they're out there because they're just trying to line their own pockets, they're trying to scam people, they're trying to perpetuate some weird scheme that's like going to change how we all live and work. And I just think those, what I guess I would call broadly conspiracy theories, are just almost always misplaced, but clearly hurts when you're talking about experts.
So if we're speaking at the general abstract level, I would say I agree with you. And I think the historical record shows that the experts have made our lives much better. Like, medical science is so much better. And we've talked about this before. The historical record over the last 100 years, people are living longer, more disease-free. There's better nutrition. There's fewer accidents on our highways. Like, all that stuff just keeps getting better and better and better. But then you go into certain particular things. COVID was one of them, where, like, we got a lot of really good advice along with some really overreaching policy and some, frankly, like, nonsensical recommendations. Right now, if you look at education, over the past 10 years, our test scores for kids in K-12 all the way through have been declining. For the first time in history since the 1950s, they're declining. So for a long time, we could say, yeah, we ought to follow what the experts are saying about education. Something's gone wrong. And a lot of the educational experts are doubling down on what they've been doing, despite the fact that anybody can look at it and see it's not working. And it's not just because of COVID. You know, like, it's a 10 years now that we have, like, it's declining. And as you dive in, you can see, well, what's gone wrong? Pretty much it's screens. Wherever screens have been adopted and adopted most thoroughly into educational systems, test scores have declined. And so you have some countries like Sweden that are just getting rid of screens altogether, tech-free education. And yet we have AI companies that are really pushing to get a foothold in the schools, and they're having all kinds of expert testimony. So all this expert saying that the latest AI agents are going to come into schools and get children more prepared to the workforce, more employable, more creative, able to do advanced work. There's all these promises. There's nothing supported. There's no evidence supporting it. Yet these are experts that are telling us this. I am frankly very skeptical. I'm worried about the economic consequences of a crash of the AI bubble when, you know, most of our economy right now is dependent on this latest technology. And I'm most particularly worried about what's happening with education, both in universities and K-12 schools. And this is all driven by experts. And so when people say, like, yeah, I'm not sure I trust experts, I would say, yeah, there are whole areas of life where I agree with you completely. I think there's a lot of reason for skepticism.
And as we close, maybe that brings us to an important question, is whether it's education or many of the other topics where we rely on expertise to help us make decisions and guide public policy, there is often going to be times where you have two supposed experts at odds about what's best. If you're an ordinary person who is not an expert in that particular field, one of the most kind of reflexive things you're going to do is like, well, person A says this, person B says that, let me go on the internet, or maybe even talk to one of my AI friends and like say, what's the best way to go? And my argument would be, you know, I mean, you can probably find an expert somewhere in this world that says climate change is nothing. Well, that person is drowned out by the 99% of climate experts to say it is. So, I mean, there are some cases where the preponderance of the evidence is clear. But if it's something that's not like that, I think where things like AI and even the internet writ large can help is help you, especially if this is something that you're going to face directly, like you're facing like a health crisis and you're like, one doctor says this and one doctor says that, what do I do? I think those can be useful tools to like say, I'm going in to talk to my doctor about this really bad health issue. What are the top six questions I should ask? And I think things like that, technology can be remarkably useful because it can help you kind of frame things up in a way for talking to people who are a lot smarter about this than you to make you sound like you've done your homework and to guide you in getting to kind of the most important part of this. To me, that's where technology can work as sort of a way to guide us to think about things, but not make decisions for us. Does that seem right to you?
If you are a person who has already acquired, I would say, kind of the critical faculty of reasoning pretty well, reasoning consistently, coherently, understanding how to put premises together into a chain that forms an argument, and you understand, like, in some basic sense, what's the difference between a good chain of reasoning and faulty patterns of reasoning. Then you can consult a source like that that gives you information and helps you put it into a context, a pattern of thinking that you're already pretty good at. You just lack some bits of information, and so it helps you process it. The problem is this. What the AI technology is promising to do is do the reasoning for us, not supply us just with the bits of information, to do the reasoning. And it takes a long time to develop the ability to think clearly, to work through problems, and to make sense of complicated things. That takes a lot of practice. And this is what we spend most of our lives do in conversation. We're always figuring out, you know, as we're talking to people and we say something and somebody questions, you know, is that right? Wants more clarity from us. So the more we're talking with people and people with different views and who think a little bit better, it creates what's called some cognitive dissonance, which makes us work harder to clarify how we think. So the more we're talking with others and we're working through problems, the better we get at thinking, the more we can make good use out of information that comes from information technology, right? Here's the problem. As we're moving to a screen-based culture, every year for the last 10 to 12 years, people are speaking about 300 words less than they did. 300 words a day less than they did before. You add that up over 10 years, about, like, that's a lot. We're speaking a lot less.
They clearly don't host podcasts, Rick.
We're not talking to strangers as much. That means we're not talking to people who are going to challenge us or present us with ways of thinking differently. We've had a rise in cognitive distortions. This has been going on since 1995. This is like pretty much since we had the internet and becomes part of our daily lives, people are thinking more irrationally. That is, as human beings, we're becoming less capable of putting to good use the information that we're getting from the information technology. And so I disagree with the fact that it's useful overall. It's useful to the handful of people that know how to use it really well. For most of us, it's not useful. It's increasing our political polarization. It's making us have shorter attention spans, and it's making us interact with each other less. And so it's when you ask the question, like, why are things seeming so much worse these days? It's largely because we're becoming worse people.
We end each show by tackling an ethical dilemma. Rick, I hear you have one for me, and I think it's related to what we've been talking about so far today.
It's very closely related. So I was at an academic conference. So this is a conference of people with really great credentials. So I went to one panel where people were talking about ethics and AI. And the two panelists, each of whom taught at different universities, but these are real high-profile universities, and these are senior professors at these places. One took an extremely anti-AI approach, pretty much like what I was just mentioning in the previous segment. I was really sympathetic to what this person said. Then the second person came up and demonstrated this AI agent that he had created that was... I was blown away by it. What it was able to do was really impressive. And he'd spent 2 years building this thing. It could answer all these really detailed questions and give really sophisticated, nuanced responses to all kinds of problems that could be posed to it. So these are two people with completely opposite responses.
But both academics.
Both academics. We had a short time for some discussion after these two presentations because they both went a little bit long.
Just to be clear, this was discussion like
in the room,
like a Q&A sort of
Q&A.
Got it.
Yeah, and it's a small conference. I would say there's about 40 people in the room,
mostly academics.
All academics. Okay. Yeah. But it was people who had spent we'd been together at this conference for 3 days. We'd built relationships. People knew one another. It's also a conference that is an annual one, so people have gotten to know each other over the years. And people were very polite. And so nobody wanted to take a real strong position and be highly critical of either presentation. So they asked a few questions. What I found out is afterwards there was a break where the people in the small group of people I was talking to were very critical of the second presentation. And I was thinking there's probably a group of people across the room that's being very critical of the first presentation. And this was never aired because people were so polite. Mm-hmm. And which doesn't always happen at academic conferences. They have a reputation for being quite rude sometimes. But I'm just wondering, did politeness get in the way of really some really constructive dialogue? And would it have been better for people to feel free to be at least appear more rude, but to be honest?
So it reminds me a little bit, and we talked about this on the show, and it's been a few years now, but kind of in the aftermath of COVID, there were all these, often around school board, local school board meetings, where you would have parents stand up and like yell at school board members, sometimes threaten school board members. And that's sure this happened in village halls and city halls as well. And like it was a very uncivil place. And I think we talked about that a little bit way back then and said, you know, it's great to have the ability to stand up and be heard by the people you elect, but you have to do so in civil ways and not do it in yelling and menacing ways. I don't remember exactly what was said back then by both of us, but it would not have surprised me had sort of the consensus opinion been that this is sort of an example of what happens when we don't have relationships built between the members of our community, where people are, you know, showing up at their very first school board meeting, not knowing these people, maybe didn't even vote in the last school board election, but have one sort of narrow, strongly held belief that they want to make sure gets heard and will yell loudly about it. This is the opposite of that. This is people who have gotten to know each other, who have over a short time gotten to, you know, have some sort of respect for each other. And that's sort of the downside of what you talk about a lot in some ways, is when you do build this community up and build these relationships up, that I think there is a hesitancy to not have asked those pointed questions. I mean, I'm sure we all have people in our lives who we care a bit about, who have very diametrically opposed political opinions to ours. And that's, I think, why many times it seems so much easier to call someone stupid about the person they voted for online, because it's a stranger, than have that discussion with someone around the dinner table. So I guess to answer your question, I would imagine, especially in the academic world, there is a hesitancy to speak out about something that you don't feel you're an expert in, like we talked about in much of the show, that you sit there and think, well, these two people have spent a lot of time thinking about this. They were invited to present on this very topic because of their level of expertise. They have clearly different opinions, but maybe I don't, because I'm an expert on ethics or on whatever else those other people in the room were experts on, I'm not surprised to hear that there were not loud retorts about that, because people, A, felt like they didn't want to cause a scene. These are people that they want to be respected by their peers.
Yes, I think that was one of the big driving motivations there.
But you also feel it was because they themselves didn't feel experts in a field that really promotes expertise and values it. Do you think that played a role?
I think for quite a few in the room, there's probably a reluctance, yeah, to especially venture a very strong opinion when they mostly have questions.
Yeah.
They have more questions than answers, so mm-hmm. they're not really sure. So it's harder to be critical when you're not sure about your own position.
Yeah, yeah. And I think that's, in general, helpful, I guess. But I also would imagine that before even showing up at this conference, you had a schedule that listed out
yeah.
these various topics, And if you're going through that and say, oh my gosh, this is something I have a keen interest in, and it looks like person X is going to take this position and person Y is going to take this position, and I think person Y is just wrong, that I think if you really wanted, if you're a good academic and you really felt that you wanted to engage there, spending a little bit of time like crafting, and also based on what the presentation says, but then looking for an opportunity to like say, you know, here's something I sincerely believe that seems at odds with what you just said, you know, convince me that I'm wrong. I think that's like healthy and good. And I think there are times where those groups can become a little hesitant to do that because I think, you know, like you said, you don't want everybody to walk away and say, oh gosh, that professor from Viterbo University, he just seemed like it was itching for a fight and he's not an expert in any of this stuff. I just wish he'd keep to himself. I mean, you don't want people saying that about you. And I'm guessing that people didn't want that being said about them too.
Yeah. You know, and I think as I look back on the situation, I think like partly what happened is we probably didn't, if we'd had much more time for discussion, it would have generated gradually. People didn't want to be disagreeable at the outset, but they were fine at being disagreeable in the small groups where they were among other people who agreed with them. That's a key. Like, is there some hypocrisy there when you're feeling very free to criticize people in a small group, but not in the large group?
Well, two questions on that before we go. One, you know, how long was each of the person's presentations approximately?
About 25 minutes.
So 25, and then how long was left for the Q&A?
Only about 10 minutes.
Okay, so it was like an hour.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Let's say you were put in charge of doing this over again a month from now in a different location. Would you say we should do maybe 20, 20, and 20 and leave more time for discussion? Or do you think that to try to encourage what you said? But I think you're right, is that it does seem like that the first question you don't want to be seem sort of overbearing, but maybe by the fourth or the fifth, you can say, well, I heard what Fred said, and now here's my take on that. And it does sort of open the gates a little more.
Yeah, you never know at the outset like how much discussion is a certain pair of topics going to generate.
Yeah.
And so that's always hard to anticipate.
And then I guess maybe most importantly, do you think that those sort of side discussions that you talked about that happened afterward where you and others were saying, well, that guy was really made some great points. The other guy seemed really misguided. And I'm guessing because these are smart people, they're sort of backing up their positions and saying, well, because in my experience, this happens and that happens. Is that like enough? I mean, is that useful in and of itself, those side discussions that even though you're not making these pronouncements loudly in the room, but you're still or do you feel people are even still guarded in those? If you're talking to a group of five people and four of those people are like, yeah, person A was the best. And then the second person's like,
yeah,
I don't want to say that you guys are full of it, but I think you are. Is that even still possibly happening?
When people are at the point where they're just shouting and they're just contradicting one another, nothing good happens. You're not learning anything. So one of the things that happens in the smaller groups is you're able to process things a little bit. And when you're presented with really difficult material, it sometimes takes a while to kind of think through it, and you have to and discuss it with others. Talking about helps you think through it and raise questions about points in the presentation that were kind of difficult to comprehend or where you had a different take than somebody else. But where you want to get to ultimately is where the serious disagreements come out for discussion. And I think what happened, and I think there was would have been an opportunity in the large group for that to happen. We maybe just didn't have enough time. Either we didn't have enough time or people just didn't want to appear disagreeable. And I think it was maybe a little of both.
As a reminder, the Ethical Life podcast is a production of Lee Enterprises. Please subscribe wherever you get your podcasts. And also, be sure to check out Rick's column about ethics, and that can be found on all Lee websites. For Rick Kite, I am Scott Rada. Thank you for joining us.